Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, where we explore the ways in which we can and must power down in a new era that is no longer exploiting our fellow humans and ecosystems. We believe in building up our community resilience, expecting further economic collapse in the face of abrupt climate change, the end of cheap oil, the depletion of our natural resources, and a possible mass extinction on our planet. I'm Bing Gong, and Bernie Steffen is taking a break today. And in the studio, my co-hosts are Mary Beth Brangen and Jim Heddle of the Ecological Options Network in Bolinas. We're going to be doing some nuclear news updates. So welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Mary Beth and Jim.
Glad to be with you.
Okay. And on the telephone, we have David Weitzman. David, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Great. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio.
Thank you.
And David is Outreach Coordinator for the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, and he's been producing award-winning educational, documentary, and nonfiction film and video work since 1982. And we're going to start off with a clip from Linda Seeley and David Lockbaum. Do you want to introduce them, Jim?
Yeah, the clips that we're going to be listening to today are from our forthcoming documentary, Shutdown, the California-Fukushima Connection. And for those of you who want to know more about this project, please go to shutdowndoc.tv. That's shutdowndoc.
D-O-C.
D-O-C. .tv. The first clips we're going to listen to is led off by Linda Seeley, who's a spokesperson for Mothers for Peace, an organization that has long been keeping the feet to the fire of the nuclear industry in San Luis Obispo around the Diablo Canyon plant. And also David Lockbaum, who is the director of Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And he's a co-author of the recent book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Please enjoy.
Okay, here it goes.
PG&E is making a full frontal assault here around Diablo Canyon because they feel really unsure about the future of Diablo in the face of the closing of San Onofre. There's a lot more pressure here now on PG&E to shut down Diablo because of the new information we have about the earthquake fault. Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors, of which there are two, that are 11 miles from where we're sitting right now, are holding approximately, 6+ million pounds of highly radioactive waste that's stored in pools that are four times as densely packed as they were designed for originally, at the intersection of at least 13 earthquake faults, and three earthquake faults having recently been discovered have now been analyzed that they converge with the shoreline fault, and these three faults together, the shoreline, the San Luis Bay fault, and the Los Osos fault, if they happen to have a simultaneous eruption, which probably would happen if there were an earthquake, they would all go. They could create a larger ground motion than the plant is designed for.
Fukushima fell to a 1-2 punch, tsunami and earthquake. Diablo Canyon is also vulnerable to a 1-2 punch. The earthquake could take away the normal supply of power. A fire, because that plant doesn't meet fire protection regulations, could do the same damage that the tsunami did at Fukushima. The difference between Diablo Canyon today and Fukushima on March 10th, 2011, the day before the accident, is that their luck ran out. Our vulnerabilities at Diablo Canyon haven't been exploited, so that's why we've not experienced disaster there. We need to take steps to protect Californians from the risk at Diablo Canyon, not put our heads in the sand and pretend that it can't happen here. When it does happen, it won't be an accident. When you allow a plant that's unsafe to continue operating, that's negligence or manslaughter or something like that. That's not an accident. It's the same reason that tavern owners can be held responsible for sending a drunk out on the roads. the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would be responsible for a problem at Diablo Canyon when it allows that plant to run, knowing it doesn't have adequate seismic protection, knowing it doesn't, it's not protected against fire protection regulations. Again, they're gambling with the lives of Californians, and that's not the role they should be playing.
What we should do is shut that plant down, both of them, both of those reactors. Now, we shouldn't put up with it. It's wrong, it's illegal, it's immoral, it cannot go on like this if we want to have a future for our children.
Hello, David.
Yes.
Did you hear that clip?
Yeah.
Do you want to chime in?
Well, let me add a little bit of what the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility is doing, and I'll speak specifically about Diablo Canyon here, because I know San Onofre is another issue, though we are filed in the San Onofre case at the Public Utility Commission for recovery of ratepayer money for that failed steam generators, which led to the closure. A settlement was announced in recent months, and the Alliance has filed opposition to the settlement, which we think is a giveaway of our money to Southern California Edison without holding them responsible for their culpability. But we'll leave that aside and go back to Diablo Canyon. Our approach is interesting, and I'll add on at the end. I know that Ms. Seeley there at the end of her clip gave a litany of issues of moral and other. It was this and that and the other thing, but there was one missing, I would add, and that is the area the Alliance has chosen to focus on. It's not economical. It's not economical to run Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. Remember, there have been four reactor closures around the country in the previous year, if you count San Onofre, Kewaunee, Wisconsin, Crystal River, Florida, and the announcement of Vermont Yankee to close at the end of this year. And the reason behind all of those closures was economics. And we see the same problem facing Diablo Canyon now today. Let me say there are about three principal issues that may end up costing PG&E so much money it doesn't make sense to run the plant. And in no particular order, those would be, one, the use of once-through cooling water from the Pacific Ocean to cool the reactor. Several years back, the state of California passed a policy that said all once-through cooling of coastal power plants had to be phased out by 2015. That was for your ordinary plant. And they gave the nuclear reactors till 2022 or 2045, which happened to coincide with the end of their existing licenses to operate, because they admitted there's extra complexity in the cooling water use at a nuclear power plant. Now, a committee was formed. Our executive director, Rochelle Becker, was on that oversight committee for the Water Board. And Pacific Gas and Electric came up with some alternatives to once-through cooling at Diablo, which included building three or four massive cooling towers on the site and switching to a closed-loop cooling system. A couple of flaws in this, or potential flaws, are, one, the price tag, $6, $8, maybe $12 billion. Remember, the entire plant, after all the overruns and mistakes, was only $5.7 billion, only, I say, $5.7 billion to build originally back in the 1980s. Could be $8 or $12 billion to retrofit to be in compliance with this state law. The Alliance's policy on this has always been, rather than make them build cooling towers, which is its own environmental issue, and spend the ratepayer money, let them operate till the end of their current license. As you see, that was built into the law. They got till 2022 or 2024. And then that's it. Plant is over. No license renewals. That is the end of the nuclear era here. They won't have to build the cooling towers, which, by the way, would have meant removing an entire section of the mountain range there to clear the land. So they won't be having to do that. They'll have gotten their license. They'll have gotten their 40 years. All the union workers will have gotten to live out their careers in those jobs. They'll have gotten what they were promised, and the nuclear era in California will come to an end at a fixed date. No exemptions, no being granted an extra 20 years. That's one way the ones through cooling situation can play itself out. Public pressure at the state water board to not cave in or roll over or say, oh, go ahead, grant them an exemption, let them have another 20 years. Where are we going to get that kind of energy? Well, in the next 10 years, I'm sure Californians, being inventive as they are, will find a way to replace that energy. Remember, with San Onofre closed, it means that almost 80% of the once-through-cooling damage of the sucking in of marine larvae, fish eggs, and so forth into those reactors, boiling them up, and essentially 100% mortality, it falls to Diablo Canyon. Diablo Canyon, now the greatest, essentially, seafood shrimp boil going on the West Coast. So removing that plant, or letting it end at the end of its license, takes away that great marine impact. So that's one issue that will cause some headaches for keeping PG&E, keeping Diablo going. The other is this concept of load following. This is a very new issue. And what this means is, and again, it's an indication of the economic problems at Diablo Canyon. Pacific Gas and Electric has begun to investigate what happens if they operate Diablo Canyon at lower power levels during those times of the day when wind and natural gas are providing electricity at a cheaper rate. That's happening. The price of wind, as we know, has fallen, as has natural gas. Originally, the boast of nuclear power was that these plants put out full performance day and night, 24/7. But what we're learning now is as new and renewable energy forms are brought into the transmission grid, there are those variabilities and fluctuations. Now, they haven't quite developed the storage technology yet for renewables, so we hope that that's coming soon. And now it turns out that it's probably expensive for them to operate Diablo with its full staff of 1,000 workers running on any shift and sell that electricity during the night when no one wants it, but they're still paying to run a nuclear plant. So they've asked if they could begin investigate to the NRC and to the state transmission grid, operating the plant in an up-and-down capacity that follows the wind or the natural gas or the other prices on a day-by-day basis. This is brand-new territory. Nuclear reactors were built to operate full-out 24/7. Dave Lochbaum, who you interviewed earlier, we heard, when asked about this, reflects on his time as a nuclear operator at the Brown's Ferry reactor in the south. And he told us they had tried to do load following, that is to say, ramping up and down throughout the course of a day or over the course of a couple of days with their reactors back in the 80s. And after a couple of months, they abandoned it as an experiment because that constant starting and stopping was putting way too much pressure on the pipes, the pumps, and the components of the plant and was literally rattling it to pieces. So it shows you they're looking to find a way to run the plant more inexpensively. That indicates financial hurt, and technically this doesn't look like it's possible. It will probably require an NRC approval to do it. That won't be an easy thing for them to get. But to us, it seems like a form of desperation when they're looking to figure out how to squeeze a few extra dollars out of this plant. We have filed in a PUC case on this issue. We have requested the data on what makes them think they can run this plant up and down over a day's basis. The data they sent us was heavily redacted. They claimed there was lots of proprietary information on long-term contracts and bids for the price of energy that we couldn't be shown. But we know they're looking at this. The answers have not been forthcoming. This is an issue to follow, and it's one that indicates there must be an economic weakness in their model. And the third issue, which of course was alluded to at the end of that interview by Ms. Steele, was the seismic issue. Among other things, we have an unresolved issue. Dr. Michael Peck was the plant Nuclear Regulatory Commission on-site resident inspector some 3 or more years ago. And before he was moved by the NRC to another location in Tennessee, he discovered that the plant is actually technically, by the letter of the law, out of compliance with its current license for what the original design basis was for the seismic threat and seismic resilience of that plant. And he filed papers saying, I have a non-concurrence. I do not agree with what the commission or the NRC believes is the proper standard for this plant. And they wrote back and said, no, Dr. Peck, you're getting a little too nitpicky with this. The plant is fine. And besides, By the end of March 2015, they'll have finished their Fukushima, post-Fukushima updated seismic studies. We'll get a better answer then. His theory was, we've got a year to go until that date, or when he filed it, there were several years to go. He says, people should not be placed in jeopardy until you get an answer in the later if they're out of compliance now. So he took his up a notch, and he filed yet another grievance with them, saying, I really still stand by what I said. Technically, legally, the plant is out of compliance. Now, the NRC was supposed to have resolved that dispute with Dr. Peck. They were supposed to have resolved it over 6 months ago. Then they were supposed to have an answer this past April 1st. Well, April Fool's Day it was to us. They still had no answer. Now it looks like an answer may be months away. Here's what this tells us, reading between the lines. If Dr. Peck's assertions were indeed just flat-out wrong, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission should have issued the statement that says, we have read your grievance. We disagree. Here are the reasons why. The fact that it's delayed and delayed and delayed tells us they're looking to figure out what's really at stake here. It's obviously not an open and shut case. So there are remain open and important pressing questions about the seismic vulnerabilities of that plant, which are not being answered to the satisfaction of the former resident inspector. Subsequently, our own senator, Barbara Boxer, has raised this question twice in a publicly televised conference with the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as has our local congresswoman, Lois Capps, when she had her chance to ask those questions on behalf of the House side of the Congress.
And David?
Yes?
We're going to have to move on to our next segment, but I really appreciate you joining us and giving us that update on Diablo Canyon. We hope you'll join us again.
To get where to look, our website for details.
Yes, please.
And downloading all of our filings and papers and reports. Please go to A4NR.org. That's A4NR.org.
And David, this is Jim Heddle. Thanks for that excellent report. And I'm wondering if there are upcoming events that people should know about.
The next 2 weeks will bring a lot of hearings at the Public Utility Commission in San Francisco. There'll be a pre-hearing conference on the case that involves the load following issue that I spoke of. And on May 22nd, for those who want to come down, the NRC will be holding its annual end-of-cycle meeting. That's the annual report card meeting on Diablo Canyon. Will be held here in San Luis Obispo. Will be held on May 22nd from 6:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Embassy Suites Hotel in San Luis Obispo. You can come and question the NRC on their findings about Diablo Canyon. As I will just conclude by saying, remember, all assertions should be subject to scrutiny when they come from PG&E. This is the same company that you know is now facing 12 federal indictments for their negligence in blowing up San Bruno, as well as the actual PUC fine for blowing up San Bruno. And this is the same corporate culture and management culture that's driving the decisions at Diablo Canyon.
Thank you so much, David.
Excellent point.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you all for having me on. Anytime, just drop me word if you need any updates or information.
Thank you, David. Bye now. Next, we're going to be talking about San Onofre nuclear plant, which was shut down last year, but there's still heavy concerns about the radiation stored there.
I'm going to introduce Donna Gilmore. We'll be hearing in this next clip from our upcoming documentary, Shutdown. Donna is the founder of San Onofre Safety and has done an excellent job as putting out information for the public in such an easy-to-access way on the sanonofresafety.org website. And after it was shut down, this plant was shut down and all the elation was still in the air, she started realizing that the thousands of tons of highly, intensely radioactive waste that's stored on site only 13 feet above high tide, right next to the ocean, between the ocean and Highway 5 down there in San Clemente,
had more problems than we ever had expected. Here's Donna.
I'm afraid we have some technical difficulties with this. Can we maybe summarize that interview with Donna?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Donna's research has turned up the fact that what we already knew was a horrendous problem with the radioactive waste and what to do with it, because it's deadly for thousands and thousands and millions of years. Now we're finding that since 1996 or 1997, the NRC has allowed Southern California Edison to use what's called high burn-up fuel in the reactor. And the high burn-up fuel, it allowed them to leave it into the reactor longer and therefore make more money. However, because it was twice as thermally hot and twice as radioactively hot, it's causing the cladding, the in what's wrapping around the nuclear fuel pellets, to completely erode and disintegrate. They hadn't anticipated this problem. They didn't even think about it. This is the way these people are in this industry. And now they don't know how to deal with it and how to prevent it from the bits of the cladding sloughing off and clogging the fuel pool pumps, the water pumps and the water filters that have to continually cool this really hot fuel. And it's also going to take 12 to 15 years and maybe more to cool in those pools rather than the 5 that was required for the earlier fuel that was used that wasn't so hot and radioactive, although it's, you know, and if you, it's so radioactive, the old stuff, that if you stood next to it within 3 minutes, you would die. And that's how intensely radioactive it is. And it has to be kept cool constantly. So if there is a breakdown in the electricity that feeds the pool pumps that's keeping these intensely radioactive rods and fuel that has been taken out of the reactor cool, if the electricity fails for any reason, then we have a problem, and we just have to pray that all the backup systems work.
The normal process, once the rods have been cooled, is to put them into what's called dry cask storage and continue to store them on site. However, the dry casks that have been in use so far are not certified for high burn-up fuel storage, nor is there any way to safely transport those fuel rods to a location away from the seismic dangers of the earthquake fault tsunami zone. So,
and also, the salt water corrodes the encasing right there at sea level.
So the point is that just when we thought it was safe to relax a little bit about the dangers of San Onofre being, since it's now shut down, we now realize that there's a whole treasure trove of highly radioactive waste for which there are so far no known safe storage or transportation possibilities.
Would you like to introduce our next segment, Gary Hedrick, with San Clemente Green, who was involved in shutting down the San Onofre nuclear plant?
Yeah, in this interview, or rather an excerpt from a meeting that was held in Laguna Beach a couple of weeks back, Gary, who is the co-founder with his wife, Lori, of San Clemente Green, and was very active in the citizen-led effort to shut it down, which was successful. He speaks about what he learned and gives advice to other people in reactor communities around the country and around the world.
So here's our clip with Gary Hedrick.
Hedrick.
Tonight,
Hedrick.
Looking across the ocean towards Japan and thinking of all the people we've met here from Japan and knowing what they've gone through and being at at the LA embassy and yelling, Saikido Hantai, and being right with them, you know, and understanding and feeling it and seeing what's going on in Japan is so inspiring. And then to have visitors come from Japan and saying they're concerned for us because we're potentially the next ones to have to endure that. And it's just, it's humbling. And at the same time, it gives me so much hope because there are technical problems and there's money problems and there's almost insurmountable problems except for the power of love, you know, and that's really what gives me hope that we're going to overcome not just the nuclear power issues, but climate change and, you know, getting reasonable governance and a better system, you know, because this system is not sustainable for so many reasons, and it's so bad, the only way it can be altered is a beautiful transition to a whole new world. And I'm just glad to see the transition. This is the beginning of something beautiful, and it begins with just ordinary people like Lori and myself that couldn't turn our backs on the situation. And once you open up, you start realizing, gosh, you know, I could stand in front of people and talk or go to city councils or confront Edison face to face. Or, you know, you discover these things that you didn't know you had powers like that. And when you have that combined experience with everyone, it's just unstoppable. I'm so hopeful for the future, and together we can do it. We've seen it here and we can see it other places too. Diablo Canyon's next.
Yay. And now back to Post-Carbon Radio. We're bringing you nuclear news updates with Mary Beth Brangen and Jim Heddle of the Ecological Options Network in Bolinas. Our next clip is Karen Haddon.
Okay.
We're going to be talking about
WIP,
the waste isolation plant in Carlsbad, New Mexico, and Texas, where they're storing that waste.
Right. And Karen is the director, the executive director of the Sustainable Energy and Economic Development Coalition. And she's been working on these issues and safe energy issues for the past 25 years. Oh, dear. That didn't work either.
No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Maybe we can summarize again.
Okay. Well, Jim, do you want to, since I went first the last time, I'll chime in.
Okay. Well, I don't know how much people know about the waste isolation pilot project in New Mexico near Carlsbad, and so I'll give you a brief backgrounder on that. This, up until just recently, was touted as the state-of-the-art wave of the future model for safe long-term storage of high-level nuclear waste. It was supposed to last for 10,000 years. It's been going for 15, and back just after the first of the year, first there was a fire.
February 5th.
Down in the mine caused by low maintenance and problems. They had to evacuate the workers from the mine, and they discovered in the process that there were many safety violations that held back the evacuation of the workers. The place filled up with smoke. They were unable to see reflectors along the walls because of the accumulation of trash. And many of them needed to be treated for smoke inhalation once they got to the top. There was an investigation into the background which turned up all kinds of weak safety regulations, a very weak safety culture, low morale, and not proper training on the part of the staff, and so on. So then not long after that, there was also a radiation release.
February 14th. But I just want to interrupt to explain that this is in a salt mine, the half mile underground. That's where they're putting the waste. And the waste is not from power plants. It's weapons waste. It's plutonium and americium.
It's okay.
Oh, now you
I
have
I think
it.
We okay. can go to that clip with Karen Haddon. I'm sorry for the mix-up. One of our players is not working.
Issues. We're advocates for energy efficiency and renewable energy, and we also oppose dirty and dangerous forms of energy like coal and also nuclear power. We've opposed nuclear reactors, and we're very concerned right now about radioactive waste. Texas is unfortunately the center of radioactive waste disposal right now. There have been other radioactive waste dumps across the country, but we have a huge one. Waste Control Specialists has a site in West Texas, and it's for, quote, low-level waste, but it's all dangerous radioactive waste. And right now, that site has been able to take Class A, B, and C, three different levels of radioactivity. We're very concerned that right now we're in a circumstance where we may get even hotter, longer-lasting radioactive waste that the site is not really, in my opinion, prepared to handle. And it's very dangerous waste that could come in from the WIP site. And this is in New Mexico. It's the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant near Carlsbad, New Mexico. They have, at that site, one of three geological repositories in the world. The other two are in Germany. And at this site, they bury, half a mile underground, what's called transuranic waste. This is elements that are heavier than uranium. They get bombarded in the nuclear processes, in fission, with extra atomic nuclei, and that makes them heavier yet. And these are very, very dangerous radioactive materials, like plutonium, like americium and curium and neptunium. Those are four transuranics. This waste has been buried at the WIP site since like the 1990s, and that waste has been going underground because it is so very dangerous.
And this is not waste from nuclear power plants, right?
This is nuclear weapons waste that's been generated through the U.S. defense program. And the site has taken about half of the waste that was originally set to go there. But now there has been a serious, serious problem at the WIP site in New Mexico. What happened first, just this year, on February 5th, was an accident, a fire, that involved a truck that is for hauling the salt. This is deep in a salt mine, and this is a very large and very old, heavy truck, 29 years old. And it hauls salt as they mine out different tunnels that they would put the waste into. They build them out as they receive the waste. And the waste is coming from laboratories around the country, such as Los Alamos up near Santa Fe, and from Idaho National Laboratory, and can come from up to 10 different facilities. So this waste has been coming in and being buried. Seven different panels have been built out in the WIP site. They're right now burying waste in the seventh of these, again, half a mile underground. And the workers were on site at the day of the fire. There were 86 people underground when this fire occurred in the morning. And a driver noticed when he looked behind him that there was fire, flames behind him. So he started out by using a handheld extinguisher, and that didn't work. Then he used the truck system. It was a manual system that used to be automatic, and it had been changed to be manual. So he did turn that on, and it didn't work to put out the fire. So he called for help, called a supervisor, and then they rolled out this very large rolling fire extinguishing system. It looks like a 1950s piece of equipment with a hose wrapped around it. And they tried to extinguish the fire that way, and it didn't work. So they realized that they had a real serious problem on their hands. You got men underground and smoke filling up the tunnels. What happened at the site that day, there's a report that has just come out by the Department of Energy, and it's an accident investigation report of the underground salt haul truck fire at the waste isolation pilot plant on February 5th of 2014. And what they found was that everything that could go wrong seemed to go wrong. It's kind of amazing that there weren't actual casualties as of yet from this fire. In the end, 13 workers did suffer from smoke inhalation. All of this ended up taking 3 trips to get people to the surface through the elevator system. And this took 45 minutes for all of them to...
Mary Beth, do you want to...
Right. I just wanted to, in the interest of time, explain that as of last week, the shipments of the transuranic waste, plutonium, americium, neptunium, neptunium, and the other one, were discontinued to Texas. That was a really good move by the decision makers, because it was not a facility that was designed to deal with that, and it sits directly over the Ogallala Aquifer in Texas, and that Ogallala Aquifer serves as a major water source for 6 to 8 states. So this is another close call. I'm hoping that the enormous amount of waste that's already there in West Texas over that aquifer does not infiltrate, but I'm afraid it probably will. And so Karen Haddon of the SEED Coalition is working to close that down and to make it as safe as possible. Also, the latest on that WIP site is that they may have to leave it closed for 3 years while they're determining exactly what it was that caused the radiation release on February 14th. And there was quite a bit of radiation released. It went out at least 26 miles. People think farther. It was plutonium and americium, both of which are highly fatal if you ingest it, if you inhale it. So the people in that area are very concerned and are very upset with the WIP management, because they have not been forthcoming with information, and they've not been transparent. So that is an interesting sort of capping of people's thoughts that this was going to be the answer for all the radioactive waste disposal. They would just put it into these salt caverns and hope for the best. Well, after 15 years already, we can see that it isn't working. And this is what happens with all of the underground geological sites that have been examined for radioactive waste disposal so far. It's just there's movement constantly, and there's water infiltration, and then there are human errors.
And nobody wants it in their backyard.
Well, of course not. Of course not. And
Carlsbad did until this happened, but I'm not so sure they're still in that frame of mind.
That's true. Yeah.
Shall we move on to the next one,
Maya.
Maya.
Right. Maya Nadison, who is the author of Fukushima and the Privatization or Socialization of Risk. And she is a professor at the University of Arizona and a very concerned mother of two. And she has a lot of very interesting things to say.
She has an excellent blog spot. It's mayasblog.blogspot.org.
And her name is spelled M-A-J-I-A. And if you just put Maya's blog, you'll find it.
Did you mention the book she wrote?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Fukushima mm-hmm. and the Privatization yeah. of Risk.
Okay, now here is Maya Nadesan.
There was just an NBC expose the other day showing that the first impulse of the regulatory agencies is to protect the nuclear industry from bad publicity rather than to protect the health of the population. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, the reason the NRC was actually created was because the public was fed up with the Atomic Energy Commission because it felt that it was promoting nuclear and not promoting public health. So the NRC was set up as a fix for the perception that the regulatory agency was corrupted, you know, regulatory capture. But the same concerns hold true today, and we see this in the wake of Fukushima. They won't even talk about the possibility of there being a nuclear meltdown in an American nuclear reactor. So yes, there's definite efforts to protect the perceived safety of the American nuclear industry and nuclear in general, and it's highly contrived, it's not accidental, and you know, we could argue that it's propagandistic because it is not reflecting the scope of knowledge, it's reflecting the information that the industry wants the public to use when thinking about nuclear. And so it's interested, it's not neutral. And that to me is very problematic.
I just recently read a report from the California Department of Health Services Water and Radiological Services Lab, and in it I could see that there were milk samples that were showing radioactive iodine-131 and cesium-134 and 137 as late as June of 2012.
Yeah, there's a plume of contamination from the disasters that is circling the earth every 30 or 40 days, and that it comes down with precipitation. And the ongoing, atmospheric releases from Fukushima are so hot that they rise high into the atmosphere. And so they are conveyed through the conveyor belt, atmospheric winds that circulate the earth, and when there's precipitation, it comes down. So ongoing deposition of radionuclides from Fukushima is going to occur. And if there are any more major, events, it just is adding to, the burden of all these contaminants in the air. So, yeah, it's there, and it's going to continue. Once it's in the environment, it's in the environment, and it's ultimately going to be bioaccumulating in animals, and plants, and in people. And we are going to, at the top of the food chain, are going to be bioaccumulating through biomagnification. And then, of course, it gets transmitted across generations. So we have to find energy sources that don't engineer our extinction. That is what we have to, and we have to create infrastructures, technological and social infrastructures that support human health rather than eroding it, or we're just not going to last very much longer. And there are many people who've come to this conclusion, as described in the Sixth Great Extinction Event book and the article that was published in, I think it was published in Nature, that kind of put this issue on the table. We are engineering a mass extinction event, which is equivalent to, a meteor hitting the earth and destroying life, and we need to become conscious about it and make changes while we still can.
Well, that was Maya Nadesan, author of Fukushima and the Privatization of Risk. Next, I'd like to give you an update on the Fukushima Ocean Radiation Monitoring Update. Since March of 2011, there has been continuous flow of 300 to 400 ton metric tons of water, of contaminated radiated water flowing into the Pacific, and it's estimated that that plume coming across the Pacific will be hitting our shores anytime this month, very soon. And what we've done in Point Reyes is have there is a site that we are monitoring right out of Tomales Bay, and in fact there are maybe 20 sites along the west coast that are being monitored now by Ken Bessler, who is a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. And he has the special equipment and the expertise to analyze these samples that we're sending him, which cost $550 each. And we've been so fortunate here to have the community respond with over $4,000 so that we are now able to have this monitoring done for 2 years, and we're hoping to get another year of sampling after that. We sent our first sampling in January, and it was analyzed, and there was no detection of any radiation hitting those shores, at least then in January. And our second sample was taken by Tom Beatty, who is an Inverness fisherman. He's been going out and getting the sampling. It's a 500-5-gallon container of water, which we send back to Woods Hole for analysis. And we had that sample April 7th, and we're expecting the results of that to come back any day now. And to see those results, you can go to the website rradioactiveocean.org and see the various sites that are being monitored. There are 20 along the west coast, two in Hawaii and one in Costa Rica. So if you want to be informed about the levels of dosages that are coming our way, go to that website. Okay, would you like to tell us about CalPWatch first?
Right. I think that makes sense because we're talking about monitoring our oceans. And there's also something called CalPWatch 2014. It's been started by Cal State Long Beach marine biologist Stephen Manley, and together with a Lawrence Berkeley National Lab physicist Kai Vetter. And they're checking kelp from 38 sites all the way from Kodiak Island, Alaska, down to Baja, California, and Guam and Hawaii. And so they're taking kelp samples from these 38 sites and checking to see if they find radioactive cesium-134 and 137, which are the biomarkers for the Fukushima radiation. Those are man-made radioisotopes, and if you have both of them, then it's most likely from Fukushima, since cesium-134 only, it has a half-life of only 2 years. So it's getting pretty degraded right now. But what they found so far was no traces of these, of that radiation in all of these 38 sites, which surprised a lot of us, because right after Fukushima explosions happened and it came down in the rain over here and along the west coast, radioactive iodine 131 was detected in the kelp. And so once radioactive iodine 131 only lasts for approximately 80 days, but the presence of it suggests that very strongly that other isotopes that came down from that explosion were also deposited into the ocean there. And you would think, see, kelp biomagnifies the radiation from the ocean water and can be many multiples of times more concentrated than the ocean water around it, as well as plankton. Plankton also bioaccumulates the radiation. So we will be continuing to keep an eye on this, and we will be asking the scientists if they are checking those same beds that showed the iodine-131 before, and also what their methodology is and how they are testing for it and how sensitive their equipment is, because this is, it's a tricky thing, and we know that the nuclear industry would rather us think that there is no effect in the biosphere from Fukushima, even though it continues to emit billions of becquerels per day, both into the air and into the ocean.
And it's to be pointed out that these civilian, citizen-based inquiries are going on in part because the government refuses to measure.
Right.
Exactly. I wanted to mention, if you want to find out more about monitoring Fukushima radiation, there's going to be an event at the Petaluma campus of Santa Rosa Junior College coming up on Saturday, May 31st, 7 p.m. at the Carol Ellis Auditorium. The presenters will be Ken Bessler, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution scientist with the expertise. He was right after Fukushima in 2011. He went over there and did the research and measured the levels of radiation. And he'll be coming to the Bay Area, so you can hear him on Saturday, May 31st, as well as Dan Scythe, the CEO of International Medcom, who manufactures Geiger counters, and he'll be talking about community monitoring systems. So that's if you want to learn more about the monitoring on Fukushima radiation, that's Saturday, May 31st, 7 p.m. at the Carol Ellis Auditorium at the Petaluma campus of the Santa Rosa Junior College. I'd also like to announce that the California Coastal Commission is meeting in Inverness on Thursday, May 15th, and Friday, May 16th. And on Friday, there'll be a report prepared by their staff on the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant disaster and radioactivity in California. And that same day, there's also going to be an anti-fracking rally to let the commissioners know that fracking is going on and the offshore drilling there. So they should be aware of that. And it's not on even on the agenda, I understand. So if you want to join that anti-fracking rally, that's going to be at the Inverness Yacht Club on Thursday the 15th at noon. It's being organized by the Center of Biological Diversity with support from Main Street Moms and 350 Marin. And if you want to join them, you should meet at White House Pool parking lot at 11:45 to carpool. So if you want to join them, that's 11:45 to carpool.
I just wanted to add that fracking is such an important issue just all on its own, and it connects to the nuclear issue because it causes earthquakes, and we don't want any earthquakes around these huge pileups of nuclear waste and the nuclear reactors.
Well, I just want to say my appreciation to both you, Mary Beth, and James Heddle for collaborating with Post Carbon Radio with the nuclear news updates. And we'll have you again, I think, in a month or two. So thanks
for
joining.
For people who want to know more, go to ShutdownDoc. That's ShutdownDoc.tv. ShutdownDoc.tv.
Or our blog, Eon 3 Planetarian Perspectives blog.
That's Planetarian Perspectives at eon3.net.